Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Candy, a.k.a. Single Mama Diva, and I am here to speak with you along with my guest, Joanne Sperrins, and we're going to talk about aha moments. And Joanne is going to share her experience with us, and we're going to have lots of fun here today. And 15 years into a successful career in high-tech corporate communications, my guest, Joanne, dealt with a number of life-changing blows that resulted in her rethinking how she wanted to live her life going forward. Despite the small voice in the back of her mind telling her for years that she needed to do something more important with her life, she did like most of us do and just continue on doing what she's doing. But then life started sending her these signals. I'm pretty sure most of you out there listening can relate to this. I know I can. First, it was her marriage that ended, and then the company that she was working for went bankrupt, and shortly thereafter, her father became terminally ill and required her care and advocacy. And a year later, if that wasn't enough, she was diagnosed with breast cancer. And I had the privilege of talking with Joanne a day or so ago and really enjoyed her energy, and I think that you guys will too. Feel free to call in and ask any questions that you would like to answer or ask, and we will answer them to the best of our ability. Also, I think what you might want to know is that I don't take a whole lot of time out for promos and things. I get directly into the topic and what's going on, because being that this is such a short show, I think that we need all the time that we could get. So without further ado, I'm going to invite Joanne to come in and bless and grace us with her presence. Hi, Joanne. Are you there?
Hi, Candy. I am. Thank you for such a lovely introduction.
You're welcome.
Excited to be here and continue the great conversation we had the other day.
Yeah, it was. It was fabulous. I really enjoyed it. I'm still kind of high from it, so I am excited.
Well, so, good.
I would like for you to continue what I was introducing you with, to kind of come in and just tell everybody about you.
Sure. Well, thank you for that. You know, as you said, you mentioned, I had a successful career in high-tech corporate communications, and much of it I enjoyed, but I had this sort of nagging feeling in the back of my mind for quite some time that I really wanted to do something more important, something that would make a difference in people's lives. And I didn't really feel, you know, while I was certainly affecting the people who worked for me and being able to mentor them, that wasn't quite enough. The majority of my time was spent really promoting high-tech products. And that while I love technology and I love to brainstorm and get strategic about things, it didn't feed my soul. And so I started, you know, and I had thought probably ever since I'd been in PR, maybe a few years in, that wouldn't it be great to work for a nonprofit? And then I'd sort of look at the nonprofit world and I'd see, well, you know, it only pays about 60% of what the high-tech world pays, and I live in Silicon Valley, which is a very expensive place to live, and I wanted to own a home, and those jobs were really competitive. And so I kind of kept doing what was comfortable, and I call it a comfortable discomfort, so something that we're used to but isn't really authentic for us. And we keep doing it because it's something that we know.
Right.
And I kept going along that path until, and what I did is I sort of conned myself, if you will, I left the company where I had my sort of aha, I need to do something to help people, and I went to a startup where I was going to get to learn a lot of new things, and I was going to get to work with the CEO of the company, and so that was going to be fulfilling for me, and I allowed that to sort of substitute for really the soul-filling work. And there was a lot of great stuff about out of that. I got to do some incredible mentoring, and I got to do some great coaching and advising with the executive staff. So there were some really great things that came from that. Unfortunately, it was a dot-com, and it was the time of the dot-com bubble burst, and our company went under. And so I found myself unemployed just before September 11th.
Wow.
And feeling like initially I thought, oh, great, I'm going to take some time off, figure out what I want to do. And then September 11th happened, and that sort of threw off my plan.
Changed the whole world.
Yes, that changed the whole world.
Yeah.
Even those of us who didn't lose somebody, you know, who was close to us, we lost a huge number of our citizens, and it was such a shocking event. And it really sort of, that was, I think, one of the things that was another reminder that it's important to do something that makes a difference in people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
Because when it comes down to it, what we really have, what's really important in life, is the connections we make with people and the interactions that we have with them. That's much more important than, you know, the fancier car and the designer handbags. You know, it's our connections with people. And so that started me thinking, but I still really didn't know what I wanted to do. And I thought, well, I'm going to put off my job search until after the first of the year. And I think it was January 2nd that my my father, who was ill, he had a variety of illnesses, but was still mobile, was walking home actually from a chemo appointment and fell and broke his hip, and it went undiagnosed. Even though we got him to the emergency room, it was many hours later, and the emergency room, the folks just didn't diagnose it properly.
Mm-hmm.
And as you probably know, some 50% of elderly people who break their hip, that's sort of the beginning of the end for them. And that's what happened with my dad. And I kept thinking, you know, he's in and out of the emergency room. I'm interviewing for jobs that I don't really want. And I'm not really sure how I'm going to fit a job into my life, certainly not a high-tech job where I have to work at least 60 hours a week and I can't really run off to the emergency room every time he's rushed there, which my priority was to take care of my dad. I had lost my mom many, many years before, and so, you know, my dad was my only parent, and I wanted to do the best I could for him. And some issues arose in terms of, you know, how to care for him, and I ended up having to do a lot of advocacy for him to ensure that he got the care and treatment that he wanted, as opposed to what other people thought was appropriate for him. And, you know, that involved getting the courts involved, and it was a very traumatic, and, you know, I learned a lot, but it was not an easy process, and, you know, that made the job hunt even more difficult, and it made it become even more important to me to do something that helped people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I had little, you know, Oprah talks about how when something's going amiss, when you're not being your authentic self, you know, the universe will give you a tap on the shoulder to kind of let you know. And if you ignore that, the universe will slap you in the face. And if that doesn't work, you know, you run into a brick wall.
A boulder falls on your head, yeah.
Exactly. It keeps getting, you know, if you don't listen to those signs, you keep getting bigger and bigger signs. Listen. And I think I shared with you the other day, you know, I had a couple of little signs like, you know, getting ready to go to an interview once and realizing that the suit that I kept picking for my interviews was the same suit that I wear to funerals.
Right.
And that's sort of, you know, that was kind of an aha. That, boy, if I'm dressing for an interview the way I dress for a funeral.
Right, yeah.
What does that say about how I truly feel about this job interview?
Mm-hmm.
And what am I giving off to the interviewer? You know, I must be giving something subconsciously that I'm not really that interested. And so, you know, that happened and the things with my dad and really kind of recognizing how, just how important, are again, our connections with people are, were really, you know, getting me going and thinking more and more, what can I do? What can I do? I've got to do something different. How do I not get back on the same hamster wheel?
No, and, let me pause here, here before you go any further, because this is such a common place for a lot of people between the ages of 30 and 50. It depends on how fast people do what it is that they want to do. But you have this thing where most people have growing concerns for their parents. They have children that they need to be responsible for. And people are really stuck. And we're going to talk about how to get unstuck from these areas, because you have on one hand valid responsibilities, and then you have on the other hand meaning-making, which is very important in adult lives as they get older, because now everything is kind of coming together, and some of the decisions that we made in our 20s or our late teens are now harvesting, and we're looking at it like, wait a minute, that's not what I want to harvest. I think I want to plant something else. And, you know, getting people to see that it's just never too late, and that anything that you actually decide that you want to do, once you really decide, as you go through and finish your story, I just want you to just kind of emphasize how the universe comes into play and just kind of pushes you along. Once you decide in your spirit that you want to do something and you take that first step to do it, the universe really assists you. And as you go through that, we'll just kind of touch on that just to kind of encourage our listeners who may be in the same spot, because I know for a fact that they are, because I hear about it all the time. But
absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, you make such a valid point. It's we may set ourselves up to thinking that there's one path that we want to follow and kind of get stuck in the idea that, well, this is the path I chose and I'm good at it, so I need to keep doing it, when in fact, certainly, and you nailed it, you know, 30 to 50 in particular, we often realize, oh, you know what, there are things that I'm good at but not particularly passionate about. There are things that I'm passionate about but not particularly good at. Where is the crossover of the things that I'm both passionate about and good about, you know, good at? And how do I figure out how to move there? And there's a great coaching model that I'll share with you in a few minutes that I think will help people in doing that moving forward. So I'm just real quickly, you know, the final straw for me was being diagnosed with breast cancer. And when I got that diagnosis, after my initial sort of freak out about it, I sort of looked up to the sky and said, okay, I get it. I'm really not supposed to go back to high tech. I really need to make a change, and I need to do it now. And I was fortunate enough to have a counselor who is a therapist and a coach herself introduce me to the world of coaching. And as she described it, you know, coaches are there to listen to what's going on with someone, to ask pointed questions to help them question their beliefs and see which ones are still serving them and which ones aren't, help them create action plans, and support them in moving forward. And she told me about that, and I said, well, I do that. That's part of my work advising executives. I do executive coaching, and I've done that in my personal life. Always people come to me for some reason, people I don't even know, and I help them in an objective way kind of look at things a little differently. And I said, you mean that's a career? And she said, yes. And I took a class, an initial class that was really about being coached, and fell in love and knew that that was what I was supposed to do, and went to coaching school and got my certification and accreditation because that was the right thing. And that was the thing that I'm good at and I'm passionate about. And that was the way I feed my soul, by helping other people have their aha moments. And there's nothing, and I'm sure that you have experienced this based on our conversations and work that you have done, there is nothing like being in the presence of someone who is having an aha moment.
Right. That is so true. And it's amazing because you have aha moments when they're having aha moments, because you're learning from them, and it's just this great exchange of energy that takes place, I think, when you are helping others realize things, because you're coming into your own realizations as well.
Absolutely. I learn so much from my clients, and it's such a gift, and I thank them for allowing me to be on their journey, because I get so much out of it as well. That's not why I do it, but that's a really great perk.
Now, what do you find to be one of the major roadblocks in transitioning for people? Because that's kind of what I'm always fascinated with, our life transitions. Although we are always transitioning, but like you say, we have these pivotal moments where we either need to make a U-turn or we need to go left or go right. Something is shaken within our foundation that lets us know, okay, something needs to be done here. What are one of the number one things that you find one of the major roadblocks in people making their first step towards transformation, and how do you help them kind of break through that very first step?
Great question. I would say fear is there, but the one that we can really work on is self-limiting beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
We often believe, whether it's based on tapes that play in our head from our childhood, we may have been told that we weren't good enough, we weren't smart enough, you know, we may have been abused, we may have been told, you know, you're only good at domestic things, or you're only good at math. So we have these self-limiting beliefs that we think are true, and they're not. There's a Tibetan term for that. You know how we have all that chatter that goes on in our minds and it kind of talks us down? Well, the Tibetans refer to that as monkey mind.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of imagine a bunch of chattering monkeys. And monkey mind, of course, is you, right? It's sort of a 9-year-old version of you who doesn't want things to change. So it's going to give you the, oh, but people aren't going to like you. Oh, but you're not good at this. And monkey mind shows up in a lot of ways. It shows up in scarcity thoughts. That's probably one of the biggest. I don't have enough time. I don't have enough money. I don't have enough energy. So someone thinking about going back to school, for example, to change careers, may be really hung up on, I don't have enough money to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Other ways it can show up is, you know, being a victim or a martyr, making excuses about why you can't do something. A really big one, this one I tend to do, is deflection. So if something comes up that makes me uncomfortable, I may resort to humor to deflect attention away from me. And sometimes the humor that I use is genuinely, I'm genuinely being funny and cracking a joke. And sometimes I know, and I'm learning to recognize it, it's a way of diverting attention somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things I do with clients is I work with them on monkey mind and on becoming familiar with the different ways that monkey mind can show up so they can start to recognize when a monkey mind thought is coming up versus their voice of inner wisdom.
Right.
Or their gut.
Right.
You know, if we're walking down a dark street at night and we hear footsteps, we listen to our gut and we get into the light, into a business, to a policeman. You know, we have no hesitancy. But in the light of day, we often don't listen to our gut. We don't listen to that inner voice. And so by using a tool such as, you know, becoming familiar with when something is monkey mind or when something is a tape playing from something that you heard from your mom your whole life, being able to become aware of that allows you to shift and start to move away from those self-limiting beliefs. They're always going to be there. You know, they'll keep popping up. But what I tell my clients, and they always laugh when I say this, but I say when you recognize a monkey mind thought, I want you to say, you know, don't engage. What I want you to say is, thank you for sharing. Nevertheless, I'm enrolling in this course. Or nevertheless, I'm taking this new job. And that way, if you don't engage, just like with another person, you know, if you encounter someone who's kind of hostile and you respond hostily to them, that escalates the situation. If you respond to them and say, you know, thank you for sharing. I appreciate your letting me know how you feel. That sort of stops all the it puts a cap on the negative energy. Right? Because how can they fight you? Right?
Exactly.
So
when you accept that these negative thoughts are there, and it may be your mind's way of doing deductive reasoning. It could be a number of things. You know, if I change careers, you know, how much will my kids suffer? How much will they gain from it? Will this affect my relationship? You know, it's normal, I guess, to look at those things. But every time when I look at the History Channel, I'm not getting off topic. I'm going somewhere, I promise. But every time I look at the History Channel and I look at the desperation of the different cultures that were just doing whatever they had to do to get here into the United States, you know, the Irish and, you know, a lot of the other immigrants that came here, they were like, we've got to get there. We're willing to do whatever it takes to get there. You know, there was this sense of desperation because people were very uncomfortable during that time. We didn't have all of the little luxuries of life that we have now. But today I noticed that a lot of the times, like what you were saying, our uncomfortableness is made comfortable, and a lot of people really are asleep. They don't realize a lot of the times that their illnesses, their nervous conditions, and all their addictions, and even some of their compulsive behavior, and some of the things that we see that are going on today with the misfiring of people's signals is what I like to call it. It's a misfiring due to wrong programming, and people just react to the wrong programming differently. They're comfortable, but they're not comfortable, and they don't know that they're not comfortable because they're not running from war, or they're not running from, you know, all of these things that were present, you know, in the 1800s and whatnot,
right,
when people wanted to come here and make a life for themselves. But if people could really understand how sensitive the subconscious is in picking up on those subtle things of dissatisfaction, not to say that we don't need to go through things, because I don't want to create the little she foo foo society where we're not kind of, where we can't toughen up when we need to. But living in a long-term state of dissatisfaction and unfulfillment in this day and time, I think is really one of the number one causes of a lot of killers and diseases and things that we're coming up on. People are dropping dead. People's hearts are young people's hearts. You know, of course, some of this has to do with defects and things like that, congenital things. But I think that we don't give enough credit to what being living outside of our purpose and our destiny does to our energy system in our body, like a dog who's not living as a dog or a wolf who's trying to be a squirrel or, you know, nature never does that. And it's amazing how nature does exactly what God created it to do. But for some reason, we as humans think we can trick our bodies into doing the opposite of what God created us to do to fit some idea.
Absolutely. And I think part of it is because we have so many comfortable things around us. Oh, I live in a nice house. I've got a nice car. I'm married. I have a couple of kids. You know, my life is fine. And we've gotten to the point where we are out of touch with who we really are, sort of our authentic selves. And so, you know, being able to recognize tapes or monkey mind or whatever, and being able to sort of sit still with yourself and go, what is it really? What am I really saying inside that I really want to do? And certainly, you know, I mentioned going back to school and money being an issue, and certainly that's a real issue, and I'm not saying that scarcity thoughts are always monkey mind, but it's about being aware and going, okay, am I just talking myself out of this because I don't want to think about the money and I'm not willing to look at, gee, how could I get a grant? How could I get a scholarship?
Right.
And, you know, if there's something that I really want to do. And what you said about things showing up as illness, absolutely believe we are more anxious and have more people on anti-anxiety medications than ever before. People get migraines. That's often because they're not being true to themselves. I mean, I'm not going to say, gee, I caused my cancer, but perhaps I did in a way. Perhaps my not being true to myself and being so stressed allowed that to show up.
Right.
And to me, it was a gift. Now, I had a very mild case, if you will, and so I was very lucky in that regard. But it was really, and I looked at it, I really viewed it as, okay, this is the boulder falling on me. This is the time. No more
right.
pussyfooting around. It's time to figure out and be true to myself. And that meant I had to figure out who I really was,
mm-hmm.
and what was really important to me. I refer to it, you know, sort of as your authentic self and figuring out what your standards of integrity are. What is it that's most important to you? And you know, standards of integrity are things like, you know, being compassionate, being spiritual, being of service to others, and kind of recognizing what those things are. And I do exercises with clients to help them figure those things out. But one of the things that I wanted to share with you is the coaching model from the school that I went to that really, really helps people, I think, get beyond their limiting beliefs. And that model is to look, see, tell the truth, and take authentic action. And looking means shifting your attention to something is more interesting. What's interesting to you? What are you willing to look at? And then once you're looking at it, you know, be curious. What are these thoughts that are coming up? What's kind of happening here? So, for example, you may be really concerned about money, And that kind of comes up when you look. And then what you want to do is kind of discern or notice or examine what's happening. And you may start to see, you know, you may want to look then at how do you spend money? Well, gosh, I have a Starbucks grande latte every day. And, oh, wow, at $5 a pop, that's $25 a week. That's $100 a month. That's $1,200 a year. Maybe I'm sort of leaking money rather than spending it. And maybe my fears about money are a little unwarranted, and I don't have the money because I'm spending it in ways that don't really meet my needs. They may meet an immediate need. And then the telling the truth is reporting what happened. Wow, I spent this year, you know, $1,000 on coffee.
Right.
How crazy is that?
Yeah.
And it's doing so, you know, the truth is something that is, truth is different from honesty. So truth is the facts or reality of a situation. It's measurable and it's objective and it doesn't have thoughts, feelings, or judgments or emotions. It's just simply, how horrible of me. It's just, I spent $25 a week, $100 a month, $1,200 a year on this. What else could I have done with that $1,200? You know, that becomes an aha. Wow, that's $1,200.
Right.
And then the last and perhaps most important step is to take authentic action. And that means something that moves you forward, a purposeful action that moves you towards realizing your goals and dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And they're usually simple and obvious. So, for example, you know, an authentic action for someone who's going back to school may be to complete an application for admission.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so someone who's thinking about going to school but afraid because of the money, well, take the first step and apply. And see what happens.
Because right.
You may get not only get accepted, but you may get accepted with a scholarship of some sort.
Right.
And that changes everything.
Yes, it does.
Right?
Yes. Yes. That's the only way I've been able to make it. Not just, of course, you know, in school, but it does apply to everything. Even when it comes to relationships, it wasn't until I embraced truth in self that I was able to connect fully in what I feel was my ideal relationship at the moment. I think that's another thing, enjoying the moment and not always looking for forever. Forever is contextual. You know, you can have forever in a moment. And a lot of the times, you know, just changing our perspectives and just actually enjoying and taking those steps as they are, as opportunities, and not necessarily as, oh, God, what is it, where is this going to lead to, you know, instead of drudgery, just being excited about it, you know. And that true thing that you're speaking of, it you have to be true to yourself, you know. And when you're true to yourself, it's this thing that comes where you're not afraid to lose. Truth binds you with yourself to where you don't feel like you're alone. You're like, okay, if I lose everything because of truth, if I tell the truth about my weaknesses to this potential partner, you know, because we're taught to hold our cards close to us on job interviews, if we're trying to, you know, win over a certain suitor for a partnership, a love partnership, we want to look this way to our parents and we want to look like this to our friends. And just kind of just letting the cards, you know, laying the cards out on the table and saying, this is my hand. You know, I'm no longer in the game, so to speak. Therefore, I can't be played. I can't be tricked. You know, and just throwing your hand in. A lot of people, don't realize the freedom of just getting up from the card table and saying, you know what, I don't want to play this game because this is not who I am. I'm going to be truthful. And people come out of the woodwork that are specifically designed for your purpose, and you're like, oh, my God, here's the partner, fits right in line with my purpose. Here's the job, fits right in line with my purpose. Oh, my goodness, I can't believe it. Even down to how you dress, you're like, okay, I was never comfortable in heels anyway. And then all of a sudden, you know, you find your style and you're comfortable. And I think that is definitely what truth does when you brought that up. That's kind of what I thought about.
Yeah, well, if you're not being your true self, then what kind of relationship, whether work or, and certainly we, you know, we have to put on some things about work. We're not, you know, we don't spill our guts when we're going to a job interview, but we still need to be authentic. And in a relationship,
right.
If potential relationship, if you show up as someone other than yourself and the person falls in love with you, they're not falling in love with you. They're falling in love with what you've projected. And
right.
I think Leo Buscaglia has a great quote, and I don't have it verbatim, but it's something to the effect of, you know, we spend all this time trying to be someone that someone will fall in love with, and then we're really frustrated when they don't love us for who we really are.
Right, exactly.
Because we haven't shown them who we really are. And, you know, if you don't show people who you really are, then there's some falseness to any connection that you have. Right?
Exactly.
And again, it's not that you have to show every single, you know, thing right away, but you have
right.
to be to you. And, you know, something I listened to another one of your shows, it was really great, with Charlie Emery, and it was she was talking about, you know, you need to do what I call self-care. So when you're going to be in relationship with someone, you need to put your needs first in the sense that you need to be true to yourself. And that empowers you to be a better partner, to be a better parent. You know, I work with a lot of women who are always putting their families and their jobs first, and they're exhausted and, you know, they get sick and what have you. And we talk about the importance of self-care. And a lot of folks initially are like, well, that would be selfish. I'm like, no, this is not about being selfish. This is about taking care of you, because if you're not replenishing the well, then you don't
exactly.
really have that much to offer. You know, everyone's
you know,
going to suffer.
It's like you look at it, my sister and I, we were both, you know, we nursed our kids forever. And so we look at, I was telling her, you know, she was talking about how tired she was and things like that. And I said, you know, remember when we used to nurse our children? I said, do you remember how if we didn't eat, they couldn't eat? I said, you know, if you don't eat and put the nourishment in your body, then the quality of your milk is going to go down. You might not produce as much milk. Your milk may not be rich enough to, you know, give the baby the nutrients it needs. It's that way throughout life, you know. And I remember there were several times when my mom would come over to my house and my kids would be, you know, crying or what have you. And I was, you know, I was eating. And my mom was like, aren't you going to feed her? I'm like, if I don't eat, she won't eat. She will be okay for 5 minutes while I eat this sandwich. Because I remember when she first got here, I was just on demand. And, you know, you do that naturally because you don't really, you haven't really found your rhythm. And then you say, okay, something's got to give here because I am just going to die. You know, you really feel like you're on the brink of death. You're so tired. And then you get the aha moment, and you say, oh, I'm supposed to take care of myself first, and then I take care of the baby, you know. And it's more true when you are nursing because the baby's taking from you as opposed to if you're bottle feeding, because if you're bottle feeding, you don't really feel that pull. And I
right.
think that when you are engaging in life, you feel that pull. People are pulling your energy right out from up under you, and you don't even realize it. And if you don't pull away and say, hey, especially if you're an introverted personality, and I am, according to the Myers-Briggs, I am an INTP, and I am, even though I'm chatty.
INFP, did you say?
You are?
an INFP, yes. Yes. Isn't it funny?
For INFP.
Yes, that's me too. Isn't it funny that here we are on the radio?
Yes. Did you say F as in Frank?
F as in Frank.
Yes, INFP. Yeah, and I'm INTP. Wow. And I just have to rejuvenate. When I go and do, if I speak, if I engage, even with my family, I have a very, very close-knit family. Even when I go home, sometimes they'll look up and they'll say, oh, my goodness, where's Candy? And I would have slipped out and taken just a 15-minute drive just to get some quiet, and then I'll come back. I just
yep.
have to do that.
Yes, I totally understand that. And that is part of replenishing the well, right?
Replenishing the well, that's what you call it.
Yeah. Because, you know, people, we and other people keep drawing water from that well. Well,
right.
If something isn't replenishing it, if we aren't taking care of it, then we're gonna run out, right? We're gonna crash. And, you know, it's kind of funny because I had a career in public relations where I had to be very extroverted, and I hadn't taken the Myers-Briggs test, but what I noticed was when I went away to trade shows, for example, and everyone was talking about, oh, what great party is happening, and this was, you know, the 90s, there was a lot of money and a lot of really great parties, all I could think about was I just want to go back to my hotel room, take a bath,
right.
order room service, and watch something mindless on TV. I don't want to go to the parties. And it wasn't until,
right.
you know, I don't know, 8 years ago or so that I took the Myers-Briggs test and found out I was an INFP and was speaking with a friend who does a Myers-Briggs assessments, and who said, you know what, you have been an INFP trying to be an ESTJ for the past 15 years.
Right.
No wonder you're tired. You know, no wonder you're exhausted. And it was really eye-opening, and it got me to understand that certainly I can be very sociable. I need to pick and choose what I do, and then I need there are days I need to take off and not be socializing or not be networking. I know people who go to networking events, you know, every night, and I personally cannot do that. And that was kind of an aha to know that, you know, I need that time to recharge. And
right.
now I can honor it. And so, you know, those are the kinds of things. I mean, aha moments don't have to be, you know, huge life-changing things. They can be small life-changing things. You know, like
right.
recognizing I need to slip out from the family gathering and go for a drive or go for a walk for 15 minutes just to kind of recalibrate. And then
true.
I can
or come in and not have to really answer questions, because you know when you come in and your kids are like, oh, I did this, and you feel obligated to hear them and things like that. My kids know when I come in, give me a few minutes, and if they give me that time, you can come up here and lay in the bed with me if you want to, and we can talk all night. But I need that initial, you know, the transition.
Yes.
That little shift there. Yeah.
Yes, I so understand that. And so that's your inner voice of wisdom has helped you figure that out. So kind
right.
of going back to, you know, how do we get, what is blocking us is we've kind of lost touch many of us with that inner voice of wisdom. And so we're not listening. You know, something will happen, we'll have an instinctive reaction to something, and then we'll dismiss it. Sometimes because we think that it's not nice for us to think a certain way. You know, I once was hiring an assistant, and I had a candidate come in, and I went out to the lobby to meet her, and I took one look at her, and I thought, absolutely not. And it wasn't about her it wasn't about her, you know, her physical appearance. It was, there was just, I just had, something just said no. And yet, and then I thought to myself, and I had this inner conversation, oh, Joanne, that's really terrible. You can't judge this person just on seeing her. You don't know her. You've got to give her a chance. You know, I did that whole song and dance. I interviewed her. The rest of my department interviewed her. We all had a couple of questions about her, but we ended up hiring her. And she turned out to be a sociopath.
Wow.
And caused such disruption, and really her behavior was so unacceptable and so, I can't even begin to describe, I won't describe it on this call, but it was absolutely amazing. And afterwards I was like, wow, I really should have listened to my gut reaction.
Trust and instinct, yeah.
Yeah, and
I... It applies to you.
Pardon me?
I said it never lies to you, that your gut never lies to you. You know,
exactly.
For some reason, we allow our minds to talk us out of what our spirit is telling us.
Well, especially when our spirit is telling us something negative.
Right.
About another
right.
person, right? Because who wants to be the person that says, you know, that looks at somebody and says, nope, move on.
Right.
You know, I wouldn't want somebody looking at me and saying that. And so, you know, my monkey mind was rationalization and justification. Like, oh, you know, you're being a really bad person by judging this person. And, you know, I worked so hard to convince myself that I was wrong because mm-hmm. it was a negative voice. You know, my voice was saying, no, stay away from this person. And so... You know, I've gotten a lot better about that, and I recognize now, and if I have a bad feeling about someone, I don't further engage with them. I won't be rude, but mm-hmm. I certainly would not pursue them for a relationship or as a client because my gut is right. My inner voice of wisdom is usually right.
It really is. It is. And I always tell people, you know, think about how you were as a child, because I remember as a child, that was when I was the most right about everything. I mean, I remember just being able to look at people and see things and, you know, just be, I was, you know, you're so, everything is so vivid and clear when you're a child, and people tell you. And maybe not for all children, all people, you know, in their childhood, but I would like to believe that that is the case, that we come here with a clean slate and we're pretty clear about instinctual things. We might not know how it all fits together, but we're very in touch with immediately what feels good to us and what does not feel good. Because we know what foods we don't like, we just know. And then adults say, well, you need to eat that, or you need to do this, or you need to do that, and, you know, this is how you need to be, and this is how you know. And not to say that we don't need guidance, but a lot of the times we internalize other people's feelings so much growing up that you lose touch with what is you and what is the other person. And I just remember having such strong feelings of likes and dislikes. I mean, it was a little annoying looking back with my family and how they used to deal with me. But you remember how we were talking about the feelings that come up in us that we feel that other people may not be aware of, but we're reacting to them?
Yes.
And it was like that. And other people would say, oh, just forget about that. Sit down here, or don't, you know, yeah, sit right here. You know, some people I just wouldn't want to sit beside. And that reminded me of what you were talking about, just going out, looking at the person and saying, no, you know, and I remember being little and thinking, no, don't want to sit beside them. No, don't want them touching me. Don't want anything that they have to offer me. And very matter of fact about it, and almost embarrassing and not very friendly. And,
right, and that's taught out of us. Yeah, and it gets taught out of us, right? We're taught, well, that's not, you know, you shouldn't judge a book by its cover. You need to be
right.
Everyone, you know, we're taught to put things in boxes. This is another thing that gets in the way of our, you know, having transitions, is we're taught as a kid, you know, here's an orange, here's a banana, here's an apple, and here's a baseball. Which of these things doesn't belong? And so we're taught to kind of put things in boxes and to not think out of the box in many ways.
Exactly.
And that's how we think as kids, right? As kids, possibilities are endless. I'm going to be a fireman. I'm going to be this. No question about, you know, what's involved in it. And granted, as children, we don't know what's involved, but our enthusiasm and our dreams are more important, or we're more in touch with them when we're little.
Right.
And then as we're socialized, we kind of are socialized out of that. And,
exactly.
You know, I think, you know, you're exactly right. If you kind of go back and look at how was I as a child? How was I? Where was I the most, like, comfortable with myself and my judgments of things? And if it was in childhood, then look at what was I doing? Oh, I was sensing, and I was trusting kind of my instincts. Like, someone just didn't feel right.
Right.
Something didn't taste right. You know,
mm-hmm.
granted, you know, and our taste buds certainly change over life, so that, you know, that can change.
They do. Yeah.
But, you know, it's interesting. I have a friend who has two kids, one of whom is pretty much a vegetarian. He's 14 years old, with the exception of the occasional steak or cheeseburger, but he really doesn't like any other meat or fish and loves fruit and vegetables. And he has a 9-year-old sister who is essentially a carboholic, white rice, white bread. You know, she'd eat junk all day if she could, and they're raised in the same household, and
right.
they have these kind of instinctive feelings about what nurtures them.
Mm-hmm. They have that.
Yeah, and so, you know, I think, granted, the one who likes all the, you know, white carbs could use some
balance
training, some balance, yes,
right.
which she gets. Her, you know, her mother works to make sure that she gets that balance. But I look at her son, and I remember when he was, you know, 3 and 4 years old, going to the farmer's market, and he would be, where other people would be taking samples of fruit, the fruit that were out, he would break off a little piece of broccoli and eat it.
Wow.
You know, and obviously his body was saying, this is what I need.
Mm-hmm. And then you have that emotional component in there. When people's emotions come out in when you're coaching them, because we only have a few minutes, because I wanted to get on, and I knew we weren't going to have a whole lot of time, but I wanted to get on the book that you edited, A Travel Guide for Living.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And I also wanted you to talk a little bit about how do you help people label their emotions, because a lot of the times a lot of emotions come up and we think it's one thing, and it's actually something else. You know, they get mixed up. How do you help people untangle their emotions? You know, maybe an example or something that you might have done.
I don't work a lot on emotions because I'm not a therapist. I'm not a psychologist. But what I will do with people is kind of delve into what's behind something. You know, I can right. sense that you've got some upset going on. What's that about? And, you know, today I was working with a client, and this was a positive thing. She had started out working on one thing, and today we realized that it was just a very small subset of what she really wanted to work on. You know, she had some goals around coming up with some recipes for dishes she could bring to social gatherings. And what we really tapped into today by going deeper was what's really important to her is establishing more community.
Right.
And
right.
food is a part of community.
Mm-hmm.
But if she just came up with a couple of recipes that worked for her, that wasn't going to satisfy her craving for community.
Right.
And so that was a really big aha for her. And
mm-hmm.
and it was really cool to be a part of that and to to watch her recognize that, because certainly her longing is an emotion, and also an intention about how she wants to be. She wants to be living in an environment that has a strong sense of community. And
mm-hmm. exactly.
So that's kind of how we look at things. So what's, we look at, what's behind what's happening and sort of separating it a bit from emotion, acknowledging that there is emotion going on and trying to get underneath it to
mm-hmm.
what happened. What happened to just make that, shift in you and not dwelling on the emotion itself because, as I said, I'm not qualified to do that.
Right. And that's kind of about what I was saying, because a lot of the times we're seeking, a lot of the times people say I'm lonely, and they think that they need someone else to complete them when it's really the disconnection that they have within themselves that makes them feel so lonely.
Mm-hmm.
And, just reaching out, it's almost like needing some spinach, but you're reaching for the donut. But if we could just talk really quickly about the book that you helped edit.
My book,
tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, it's called Choose Your Life, A Travel Guide for Living, and it's written by a former school psychologist named Karen Gedig Burnett, and she's written a number of really great books for young kids. This was her first book for older kids and adults. And it's really about what is our responsibility in shaping our lives? You don't need to listen to other people. Most of what other people say, especially when they're being cruel, is about them. It's not about
right.
you. So it's really about empowering young people in particular to recognize that they have this amazing power of choice. We as human beings have this that distinguishes us from most other animals. We get to choose. We get to make choices. And we can make choices regardless of what someone else is doing around us. And how do you learn how to make the choices that are right for you and not be pushed around by somebody else? Because somebody else who's pushing you to do something that goes against your gut, against your inner voice of wisdom, doesn't have your best interest at heart. And so
exactly.
this is, it really addresses, look, there are all these choices we have to make, and here are some ways to help you kind of navigate friendships, decisions about jobs, difficult family situations, how to dress, if you're being pressured to dress a certain way or you're being judged, how to understand that most of what's coming at you from other people is about them. And you get to decide about you. And here are some ways to do that.
We only have a couple of minutes left, and I want to get your contact information out there. I don't mean to cut you off, but I definitely want people to get in touch with you. Your telephone number is 650-368-3297, and you can reach Joanne at Joanne at Volo Coaching, VOLOCOACHING.com, or you can go to her website at www.zolocoaching.com. And Joanne, thank you so much for coming and speaking with me, and I hope we can do this again.
Oh, thank you. I would love to.
Out there, I hope that you were able to grasp some of this in this quick 60 minutes. And as usual, reconstruct the world by reconstructing your mind. I know you can do it. Bye-bye.